Hello, WGN listening audience.
Live from the biggest small town in America, it's the Saturday Night Special with Amy Goode.
Saturday night. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth. Welcome to our, Tom Hush, can you believe this, final broadcast from the Michigan Avenue Showcase Studio. I cannot believe it at all. Well, indeed. So tonight is also our annual Books and Literature program. And as I said in the opening monologue last year of the book show, the books we read, both nonfiction and fiction, offer a retreat from the sometimes confusing and challenging world while also helping us to better understand it and better grasp all of the knowledge we possibly can that exists within it. Indeed, literature and really stories of all kinds help us better understand ourselves, our communities, our histories, the people we know and people on the other side of the world, and even help us try to make sense of big issues that often have many narratives and of events happening in the world around us. Obviously, those words will long ring true of the things that we read. So as we are reconvening our annual literary discussion tonight, we're especially focusing on nonfiction storytelling and hidden stories, those narratives that sometimes require a little more work than simply drifting along with the way the story has always been told. As with our books, so in the stories in our lives, right? So we'll talk about the books that we love, books that moved us, Chicago and Midwest connected books and their histories. And of course, we'll also take a look at the Chicago literary community and why there is nothing Second City about us. And with many things we tackle on this program, there's always more to it, right? Stories rarely exist in a vacuum, but rather are often in response to social or political, emotional or personal struggles of some sort. Literary events, too, play a bigger role than simply hearing someone read while standing at a microphone, but especially in a diversely storied city such as ours, with such a rich history, who is at said microphone matters, just as it matters who is in the audience. So as ever, while our topic tonight is the simple and unassuming nonfiction story, regardless of it being read on a page or on a screen or told person to person, the topic nonetheless is a rich one and one with many, many stories hidden just below the surface. So tonight's show is a love letter in a way to the many storytellers who make up the literary community here in the Midwest, those here now, those yet to arrive, and those long gone. Each word has built the pantheon that is Midwestern or even Chicago lit. And while plenty of writers have been merely passing through our fine city, Chicago, the city of work, the city of getting it done and all without a scrap of pretension, leaves little marks in their work. And in tonight's theme of hidden stories, stories lesser told, we have much, much ahead. I'll be talking with author Elizabeth Sun about her new book, Embodied Reckonings, with journalist and managing editor of the MLK 50 Justice Through Journalism Project, Deborah Douglas. I'll be talking with Martha Bain and co-curators of the Misspoken Local Reading Series about their work, as well as other events and books and things and wonderful literary stuff happening right here in our fine city. So we will be right back to get that conversation underway here on 720 WGN. Of course we had to play that song. Well played, Tom Hush. So tonight's the annual books show, where we talk about storytelling and things happening here in Chicago in the book world. And so how could we possibly have that conversation without many of our guests that will be here this evening? And our first guest is Martha Bain. She has been on this show before. We have talked to her. We talked to you, Martha, last, I think, right after Rust Belt came out.
Correct.
That lovely anthology, which we shall discuss a bit. But you have another book.
I have another book.
Tell us about the new one.
The new book is called Red State Blues, Stories from Midwestern Life on the Left, and I'm holding it up here for the radio audience, or maybe the random people
walking by
outside.
There's a couple of cameras
outside
for people watching online.
So this is an anthology of essays about Stories from Midwestern Life on the Left, which out yesterday. It was its official birthday from Bell Publishing, the small press that I work with based in Cleveland. And it's a collection of essays about kind of the lived experience of being a leftist or a progressive or whatever you want to call it, a Democrat in the Midwest in 2017, really, was when it came together.
But so it was really kind of teeing off of the presidential
very
election.
Very much so. Especially, I mean, I know you were talking about how one of the themes that you wanted to work with this show was about unexplored narratives.
That's right.
Or subverting expected narratives.
Yes.
And so what this book is really about subverting the red state, blue state narrative, which we all know is bogus anyway. I mean, a lot of these states are purple, and that's a whole other discussion.
Most of them are, sure.
Most of them are, but especially people talk about, oh my God, the Midwest flipped red, and really it was like a couple states that flipped by really, really razor-thin margins, and mostly people just didn't come out to vote at all, and there's all these other things. So so this is Red State Blues.
Yeah. So a lot of your work, especially these last two books, mm-hmm. really focuses so much on you know, the Midwest in the case of the new book, in a political perspective and aspects of it. But the book before in Rust Belt Chicago, you know, there's so much. It seems like you're often really challenging what the Midwest even is and what it means to be Midwestern.
Yeah, well, Rust Belt Chicago was specifically organized to sort of try to answer this question of, is Chicago part of the Rust Belt? Mm. Like, what is the Rust Belt? What do we think of as the Rust Belt? Geographically, Chicago is part of what is normally considered the Rust Belt, which is sort of this industrial swath around the Great Lakes from Milwaukee to Detroit and Cleveland and Buffalo. But, you know, Chicago's obviously bigger and more economically diverse and all these other things. So that was the organizing idea around that book, was like to try to figure out how Chicago fit into that narrative and how it didn't.
Mm-hmm. And what did you get surprised by during that process of answering that question?
I don't know. That's a good question, actually. I mean, I definitely went into it with my own predisposition, with my own answer, which was, of course, Chicago is part of the Rust Belt, especially if you look at the South Side, the West Side, the legacies of industrial development around here. But I think what was surprising to me about the book was I really hadn't thought as much about kind of the ecosystem, the natural world and the landscape and the ecosystem of the Great Lakes and the ecosystem of the Midwest as a contiguous area. And a lot of writers sent in some really beautiful work around that idea. And that wound up being a really resonant theme in the book.
Mm-hmm, definitely. It's a lovely book. And I think the first time I saw a picture of the book cover, I was like, we need merch.
We have posters.
I need posters
we
and shirts.
Posters.
It's very beautiful. And it's Tony Fitzpatrick.
Tony Fitzpatrick,
right?
Beautiful print that he let us use for the cover. And I actually do have posters, and I'll be selling them at Printers Row next weekend.
Nice. So, there's a reason we timed the book show right before Printers Row. And so when we, you know, I'm very interested in this topic personally of challenging that idea of what the Midwest is and is not, mm-hmm. because I think particularly in the publishing world, I think for such a long time, it was the place you left,
mm-hmm.
and you went to a coast, usually New York, mm-hmm. and then you were serious and mm-hmm. meant it. But I think there was a shift probably like the early 2000s where a lot of independent presses were struggling and a little bit less so in the Midwest because we kind of already had this, we're in it by ourselves anyway, kind of bootstrapping mentality.
And we have low overhead.
Right. Also that, yeah. Which helps, right?
Which helps a lot. I mean, it helps a lot.
And it really seemed like when so many small presses on the coast, particularly in New York, were really struggling to stay afloat, and many did not, which is not to say it was entirely wiped out, but it seemed like there was a lot more durability mm-hmm. here.
Well, that's the thing. You know, you talk about that. People talk about that in terms of the arts culture of the Midwest or just even Chicago, but that, you know, that there's space to grow. There's space to grow slowly. There's space to make mistakes as opposed to when you're in New York or Los Angeles, you know, the spotlight of whatever industry you're trying to succeed in is just like blinding you the entire mm-hmm. time. I'm a big fan of working in the margins. So,
and
not, you know, and allowing yourself to kind of mess up and fumble your way through things. So, I think that the Midwest definitely allows for that, and it allows for experimentation. It allows for, Oh my gosh, what was there? I was reading something somewhere. I'm going to mangle this quote, but it was a quote from a small press publisher, may have been Grey Wolf, which is in Minneapolis, saying something about, like, always follow the weird idea. The weird idea is the one that's right.
I love it.
And that you, I don't want to, you know, make horrible generalizations, but I think that it's easier often to follow the weird idea in the...
Sometimes.
When the pressure's a little off.
Yeah, sometimes. But I think sometimes it takes some guts to follow the weird
idea. It always takes guts to follow the weird idea.
You know, just as with kind of tonight's theme of narrative. I mean, sometimes it's very easy to float along with a dominant narrative instead of really challenging it and kind of pushing
back. Because when you follow the weird idea, people are always going to think that you're crazy for a while. And you have to have a lot of internal fortitude to kind of...
Did my mom send you to say this to me? Yeah. Because this is a thing.
I tell myself this all the time.
Right. So a lot of times when we're talking about this world and this realm, we're talking about authors in particular. Mm-hmm. But I'm very fascinated by the role of anthology. I love anthologies. They're so interesting. And they really take a very special touch. And you've managed to do this successfully. And what I wonder if you could just talk a bit about that part, because it's really... you know, it's curator. It's centering a theme without overlap, without repetition, and how, you know, where do you begin there?
It's being an editor. I mean, to me, that's what an editorial job is people call it curation now, but to me, it's editing, and not in the like copy editing sense of the word, but in the sort of like having the overarching vision and trying to find work that will support that vision. People are waving at us.
That is what I will miss the most about this studio.
I know, it's so sad.
Is people that walk by and wave and say hi, especially when little ones stop and wave.
I know.
That would be very sad.
Cute. You have to... I was a books editor for a long time, although it's been a while, frankly. So I feel like for a while I had a really strong network of... writers that I worked with in Chicago. And I'm not in any kind of like formal... editorial capacity in Chicago really anymore, but I do still have, you know, I do still feel like I still know some people. So you have to,
she
really,
said very modestly,
you have to,
you know, a lot of people.
You have to,
and everyone knows you.
You
also
have to put the you have to put the word out to your network, but you also have to get beyond your own network, and you have to recognize that your network is just one fraction. You know, I don't know poets. I don't know, you know, all these other, I don't even really know that many fiction people, although I'm going to a party later that's going to be full of fiction writers.
We might be going to the same party later.
Maybe.
I could see that being the same party.
Okay, that's entirely possible.
Nonetheless.
Editing. So yeah, editing. You're trying to... You know, all of our anthologies start out with an open call. Like, we just put the word out and say, we're looking for work that, and this is kind of what we're looking for, broad strokes. People send the material in, I look at what we get, and then I strategically try to fill in holes. I'm working on that right now with the next book that I'm working on, which is another book about Chicago that's scheduled to come out next spring. And this is one of those things where, with the open call at least, I got a ton of great submissions from the North Side and very few from the South Side. So now I'm really trying to reach out to writers on the South Side and try to get representation from those communities as well. Because it's a neighborhood-based book. It's a book about writing about Chicago neighborhoods.
Oh, lovely.
So, yeah. Anyway. So
it's such a fine city.
It's a big city, though. That's the hard thing about doing these books about Chicago is that with Belt, we're based in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. We cover places like Flint, Youngstown, Akron, Cleveland, Detroit, cities that are, some of them are quite large, but none of them are as large as Chicago. And so when you do a city-based anthology in Flint, it's a somewhat more manageable project than doing a city anthology in Chicago when you're trying to cover 77 different neighborhoods and... everything else. So.
Right. I still do wonder, you know, in particular, the work you're doing, it seems like you have to so purposefully challenge the dominant narrative about place so often through other people's work.
Yes. Yes. And what, you know, with the Chicago book, with Rust Belt Chicago, what I really wanted to do was to challenge the narrative, like the classic kind of macho narrative about Chicago, which has definitely been, it's, a lot of people are working against that narrative at this point. But it's still one that's very, very dominant, especially once you get outside of the city. Once you get to the coast and you get people who are, you know, still think that Chicago is all Upton Sinclair and
sure.
Studs Terkel, who I love. But,
right.
You know,
but we're many things.
But we're many things. We are many things. We are women. We are black and brown. And we are all these other things. So we are young.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not young, but we are young.
So we're young. We're young. Both are.
trying to really elevate that aspect of the literary community here.
Yeah. And can you tell us any more about the next one, the one that you have calls out for now?
The one, it's called the Chicago Neighborhood Guidebook.
Okay.
And it is the third in a series of books that we've done along this model. We've done a Cleveland Neighborhood Guidebook and a Detroit Neighborhood Guidebook. And what they really are essay collections. They're collections of personal essays, place-based essays specifically, which I kind of had to really hammer home to over and over again in the call for submissions. Like, I want a piece about, about Woodlawn. I want a piece about Pilsen, about your experience growing up in Little Village. I don't necessarily want a piece about riding the Western bus,
mm-hmm.
which is a completely worthy subject. It's just not right for the editorial structure that I'm working
different
with.
Different anthology. Yeah.
So that's what it is. With this book, my vision is to include every single Chicago neighborhood, but I can't include an essay for every single Chicago neighborhood because the book would be 800 pages thick and cost $40 and everything else. So I'm hoping to include, it's looking like it'll probably be about 30 essays, and then fill in the rest with some interstitial material, some archival material, little one-pager type things, lists, maps, cartoons, stuff like that. So cool. I'm hoping that every single neighborhood will get represented somehow, but it's all work in progress. The manuscript's due October 1st, so working on that this summer.
One of these days, yeah. I'm going to actually write something for you.
Hello.
We'll see.
We'll
I'm going to try anyway.
We'll talk. At the party
that we may or may not both be going to the same one. Well, Martha Bain, always a pleasure. The book is called Red State Blues: Stories from Midwestern Life on the Left. The book before that is called Rust Belt Chicago,
correct,
an anthology. Go get them both
at Printer's Row next weekend.
There you go. Easy enough. Just trot on down to Printer's Row, find it, meet her.
We'll be in the small press tent.
Which is the best tent. No offense to all the other tents,
it's a really good one. It's a good tent.
Indeed. Well, thanks so much.
Thanks, Amy.
All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. I know that if you are listening from afar, this perhaps is not an issue to you, but I'm just going to say it again because it's weighing upon me, and that is, it is our last broadcast as far as we know. Now, I could jinx us and something could happen, but as far as we know, it's our last broadcast from the Michigan Avenue beautiful glass studio. We're moving to our new WGN Radio home, and I'm surprisingly sentimental about the whole thing. So, of course, I wanted the last broadcast to be our annual books show that we do right before Printer's Row Lit Fest every year because, you know, books are great. Stories are great. We love that kind of stuff, and we love the literary community of Chicago. And so we have brought back a guest from last year, and that is Rosamund Lannan. She is the co-host of the Misspoken Storytelling series. It's the last Wednesday of the month. Is that right?
Hello. It is the last Wednesday of the month. The last Wednesday of the month every month of the year except December when we winter in other places.
Genius.
By that, I mean, we mostly stay in Chicago.
Don't go outside.
Right. You get where I'm going with this. I'm like, by winter, it sounds very fancy, but we don't really, you know, yeah, we take a break.
Sure. As everyone deserves to do. And so the Misspoken series is anytime someone is kind of saying, where should I, I'm trying to get into that world. I was like, start here. Go to this one. It is wonderful. It is great. And it's, I'm going to let you talk about it and not tell people about your series, but I will extol its virtues.
Oh, thank you. So Misspoken is a Lady Live Lit show. And what that means is personal essays and nonfiction by the female identified. I co-host it with Jasmine Davila. She is my co-host. And unfortunately, she is at a University of Chicago event tonight because she's fancy. And I have this idea that all University of Chicago events are basically like Hogwarts. And she's done nothing to disprove me of that notion. So Jasmine, I hope you're listening. You're here in spirit. And also, I made a weird cutout of you that's standing next to me.
As you do. So by default, this series really fits well with tonight's theme about untold stories and hidden narratives and that kind of thing. And so what is Well, let me actually, this is kind of a two or three part question, but this time last year when we were talking about your series on the annual book show.
Oh man, last year, so long ago. Not so, really, but yet really.
But yet it seems like a lot of things had not happened. Me Too was not a thing. Time's Up was not a thing yet. We were not having this kind of thankfully aggressive discourse about a lot of topics that have been in your series for a long time.
Yeah, it's interesting because every once in a while, like every few months or sometimes every few weeks, you kind of think to yourself, like, why am I keep doing this? You know, like Live Lit is pretty saturated in Chicago. And then suddenly a movement comes along to remind you in a huge way why, yes, it's important. And it's always been important, and clearly it's still really important. At one point when we kind of did, at one point we did some recap, and we're like, why do we do this? You know, like having a state of the state, like you sit down with your project, like you're talking about your relationship and you're like, okay, what are we doing here? And I think at one point, this was pre-Me Too, we were like, well, you know, still there are a lot of laws being passed that don't favor women. Women still don't enjoy direct standing in many areas of society. So like that was enough. And then Me Too happened and cracked a lot of things open. I have a cousin who's about a decade younger than me. Hey, Nora, if you're listening, you're probably doing fun college things. That's fine. But, you know, I was trying to explain to her recently just kind of how huge yet not enough this is, mm-hmm. but also how huge it is. There were so many things that, I'm going to be blunt, I took for granted that would not change very quickly. And they're still not, but there are trickles in the right direction. But to bring it back to Misspoken, I think that many times women's stories are not given the spotlight, you know, both because of, you know, Me Too and, you know, they're given the spotlight only when things are bad sometimes. And I think we want that to be out there, but we also want to show kind of the diversity of women's experiences. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do think it's still very relevant. And I think, you know, misogyny is very baked into our culture and we're seeing how baked in it is. And because of that, I can't get enough of ladies talking about lots of things, bad right. and good and funny.
Right. You know, that reminded me of that last year we had Michelle Weldon on, who does many things, journalist and facilitator and memoirist. And she was talking about how the role that memoir served for women's voices is a lot of times in a literary context, like when women's voices were not being taken seriously, memoir was like a way in to get a giant book deal. But it was often through a look at this humongous hurdle I had to overcome for you to hear my story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing about the Live Lit scene is that it's very accessible. You were saying memoir is a way in, and I think women have always kind of had to find ways in, because if you look at the Western literary canon or most literary canons, we are not there. And when we are there, it's the exception, not the standard. So I think with memoir, with like live storytelling, with comedy, there are ways we can talk about very important, enormous things and make them more accessible. And I hate to say this, but believable. I mean, mm-hmm. I can't count the number of times where we've had a show and this is heartening in a way, but also very, you know, tough, where someone like, I had no idea that happened. And they're not always male either. They're male, they're female. But I think in getting those stories out there, people are just getting a much broader scope of what it means to be female in a lot of different contexts.
Yeah. So in the past year, as people are submitting work or sharing work at your series, how have you seen work change?
We do, our July theme is catcall, which we chose, and that was pretty deliberate. I think people are less kind of scared to talk about raw things. Mm-hmm. But this is going to sound strange. I feel like we've always been kind of a safe space for that. I feel like there's more of it, but it's never been something that's been kind of absent from our discourse. I feel like one thing that we try to do is we're creating a supportive environment. You not only can you swear as much as you want, you can talk about whatever you want. There's times when people will say, like, is this too, you know, is this too weird? Is this too rough? And no, it's not. It's always been a place where, you know, you can be raw and real about stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can personally attest to that. I participated like 2 years ago, maybe I did that.
Yeah.
And read part of my diary when I was a teenager.
It was amazing.
So
it was delightful.
And I didn't feel like uncomfortable doing so.
Yeah. It's definitely an audience, a mixed audience, you know, that's very receptive to what you want to say. And I think that's also something, a lot of times personal stories, by the sheer fact of it being personal, and that means emotional, and that means not logical, and that means men aren't going to listen to you. Mm. I'm going to be super blunt. Like, that's, I think that's the fear of putting things out there, or is this doesn't mean something. But I think if a lot of people are saying, first of all, I think that's a poor criteria for determining what means something. But we, you know, we only have limited time, so I'll stop there. But second of all, it's if people are saying something, that is someone's real experience. And whether you agree with it or find it strange, or it's something that is
unbelievable.
Or unbelievable. Yeah. Exactly. It's something that I hope it helps people unpack, like, how, what their reaction is to it.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we're talking right now with Rosamund Lannon. She is the co-host of the Misspoken Storytelling Series. We're going to take a little break, continue this conversation here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. It is our annual Books and Storytelling Extravaganza here tonight. What better theme to have on our final show, as far as we know anyway, in the Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue, where we get to wave at all the people. So we have Rosamund Lannon with us. She is the co-curator of the Misspoken series, which happens the last Wednesday of the month right here in Chicago, except for December. She winters elsewhere. In December.
By elsewhere, we mean my house. I don't leave the house, but
winters
makes you sound really cool.
Fancy.
Yeah, fancy.
You sound like a super fanso when you do that, Sam. So nonetheless, we were talking about your series and kind of the particular role that it plays in the live lit scene in Chicago. And when did your series start?
Oh, gosh. We just celebrated, this is lucky, actually, I can remember this. We just celebrated our fourth birthday.
Nice.
We are in nursery school. We are fairly verbal at this point. We're ready for kindergarten. We're hitting all the big milestones. We started in May of 2014, and we just turned four. So.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about kind of the role of the curator in a series, because people are submitting their ideas and work to participate in this. And I have to assume, you know, with the last guest, Martha Bain, we were talking about curating a whole experience through an anthology, through all these other people's work. But I have to think it's very similar to putting together a show every month, especially around a theme.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we strive for a blend of voices. It's interesting. Anthologies, I think the toughest thing about them, and again, this parallels a show really well, is you don't want things to sound disconnected from each other, but you also don't want everything to sound the same. And I think, you know, when we're looking for voices in our show, we're looking for diversity in every sense of the word. And one thing I keep thinking about in particular is we want to talk to women over 50 and under 20. I think Gallery Cabaret is a bar, so they can't be under 20. But we're looking for there's one thing I've been thinking about in these current times is different contexts. I think sometimes when I hear people talk about how, you know, the way of the state of the world right now, which admittedly pretty rough. But I think one thing that has helped me is reading history books and talking to people not like myself, whatever that means. Maybe you're 40 years older than me. Maybe you're a different race than me. Maybe you're XYZ. Or maybe you just had a different experience than me. It kind of forces me out of my navel-gazing, everything is the worst, that I get into. And it gives you a different sense of, like, if nothing else, it just gives you context for how things are. In one of our shows earlier this year, You Throw Like a Girl, we had Margaret Benson on it, who is in her, she was around before Title IX and mm-hmm. remembers Title IX. And that was fascinating and really interesting. And I think what I have to kind of do to keep my head up is remember that progress is slow and it cycles back and forth and things do happen and you kind of have to look at what did happen. And I am not being, you know, Pollyanna or overly optimistic about this, but I think you just have to see that, like, this is not just one slice of time. We are, you know, we are in a history and women and people of color have never been treated particularly well. The pendulum's just swinging back. So right. Talk to people in some way, or listen to people not like you.
Right, right. At the very least, talk with.
Right.
Maybe not too, right?
Right.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's an important point to make because in fact, the second half of the show tonight, we're going to talk a lot about history and untold stories in history. So that'll be a topic we're coming up against for sure. And so But on that note, as people are in your audience, and I'm sure you have a lot of regulars that give you a lot of feedback and you hear from them. And I know I've seen people tweeting about your series like right after it and things
like
that.
No, I'm kidding. That's
awesome. It was all quite positive. And I think, I feel like I recently saw you tweeting cards or something. People were writing memories on them.
We've been kind of incorporating some more audience interaction into the show lately. It's been pretty fun. I think also like it's fun to kind of do something and have an activity, you know, there's active listening and then there's listening, but also we want to kind of jog the audience's mental processes a little bit also. Like, most recently, we asked people, our last show was Fangirl. It'll be up on iTunes soon. But we asked people, what was your most fan moment? And it kind of gets your wheels turning. Like, what have you gone above and beyond for?
Oh, my God. I wish I was in the audience. I have the most embarrassing fan story.
What's your... No, please. Sorry, that was loud. What is your most fan moment?
Regular listeners will know this story because I've referenced it before. But the short version is I am a very big Morrissey and Smiths fan.
Do you? How do you feel when he talks lately?
Not so good.
Me neither.
Yeah, not so good.
I'm like, ooh, stop. That's but your, like, use your inside voice.
Yeah. But like in the late 90s, early 2000-ish, I saw him in a music store. And my plan was I'm just going to casually go up there and be like, hey, what's up? Because he was looking at a CD that I owned.
Dying quietly. Keep
right?
going. Yeah.
He was looking at a CD that I owned, and I was like, I'm just going to like just, saddle you know, up like he's nobody. Like, oh,
fine.
You should totally buy that CD. Oh, what's up, Morrissey? Hey, what's up?
Just in the
That's my plan.
Every time someone tries to pretend casual, like when I try to write an email that I'm like, hey, guys, just talking about, it sounds horrible.
It sounds crazy.
Like an alien or a dog is typing at your laptop, like writing an email being like, what are you doing? So don't ever try to sound casual in life. Lean into that you really care about it.
Lean into the thing.
Go on. But tell me
So I did not. And so my plan is I'm just going to like reach over and like tap the edge of the CD, like, hey, look at that CD that you have that I also own. You should get. But I kind of freeze about halfway. So picture like E.T. pointing at Elliot.
Okay.
I just have like a finger extended almost touching the CD.
Oh.
And he looks at me and I look at him. And then I'm like, okay, stop and just say, I'm a huge fan. But instead, what comes out of my mouth, I'm going to back up from the microphone and make the sound that I made. Oh. I went, I made a noise like a pterodactyl.
You were doing so well for a minute, too. I was like, I'm a huge fan. Totally smooth. Not weird.
I made a pterodactyl noise. And then I really freaked out. And so I just kind of ran out of there. But I ran into a cardboard display and like tripped. It was very bad.
Wow.
Fast forward several years, I had the opportunity to interview him.
Oh.
And I was like, I'm going to be cool and open up with like, remember that time? And then we're going to laugh.
You got a funny story. Yeah.
It's going to be great. My editor found out about that and took me off the story.
No.
Because it was like, you're going to make Morrissey so uncomfortable.
Wow. That's
good. I couldn't have fit that on a single card.
I mean, you just Morrissey finger touch E.T.
I tried to touch Morrissey and I screamed at him like a pterodactyl.
That's
fell
good.
Into a cardboard
that's,
thing.
That's like that's a few sentences.
Poor esteemed producer Tom Hush is laughing because he's heard this story.
Tom, I haven't heard it before. But to get back to the topic, I think that's interesting because you know what is fan culture?
Right.
You know, like especially for women who are huge fans of a lot of things. Mm-hmm. We are an enthusiastic gender, as it were.
Yes,
and like.
But yet our fanship is often questioned.
Oh, yeah. There's this great quote. I think it's by Jessica Hopper. And if I misquote this world, I am so sorry. Replace the word fangirl with expert and then see how you feel about it. Like, we don't call men like Mac fanboys. I mean, some people do, but we don't call male interest frivolous. There's lots of things that men get obsessive over. And that's very studious.
Oh, that gave me goosebumps. That's good.
Yeah.
Now of course, Amy, you are going to remember how you reacted the day when someone comes up to you because they're a fan of yours.
What? That's not a real thing that happens, though.
Be patient.
Oh, okay. Sure. I mean, that'd be great.
Be patient. Just remember all of this when someone geeks out on you.
Okay. I would be like, why are you screaming like a pterodactyl? Be cool.
I think what you're trying to say, Amy, is that your preferred method of being approached by fans is a pterodactyl scream and touching something with one finger close to you, but not actually you.
I think my preferred method would be like, hey, what's up? I'd be like, hey, what's up you? And it would go like that.
That sounds pretty good.
That sounds
good. I guarantee
good.
No fan will ever be that smooth. Or when you see someone you love, suddenly you're sweaty.
You're like,
a sweaty person.
Fangirl equal expert. That is an excellent point.
Yeah.
I'm going to hang on to that one for a while.
Well, and I also think there's a lot of layers to fandom these days. The internet has kind of blown up the idea of how close fans can get to creators. And it's both fascinating, but also it's kind of weird, you know? There's a lot of gender things baked into that as well, whereas finding out more, I think Bill Cosby was also not something we talked about last year.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see just in light of, you know, this kind of tiny trickle of a revolution that we're having with Me Too, how that changes the nature of fandom and like where do you go with someone, like what it's opening up a lot of questions that I think we should definitely talk about.
I don't think a week goes by without someone tweeting something like, okay, these are the people on my list that I will, you know, like every time a man has been accused of something in this era, it seems like people tweet a list like, okay, if these five people get accused, I don't know what.
I'll die quietly. I'll let you know mine is former President Obama.
Okay.
And I feel safe in saying that because it's never going to happen.
That's probably safe.
I feel really safe about that. But it's kind of... I think it's not, the answer is not simply like they're canceled forever, you know, though in some cases that's a fair response.
Sure.
But I think it's more as like what is so wrong and systemic in our culture that this is considered okay by so many, you know, by so many people. And this has gone on for so long. I think I'd really like people to look beyond, listen to the stories of women who are talking about this and think not just like that person is terrible, but what's going on here? Like, there's a reexamination of gender that we need to take into account. And on a lighter note, a lot of our answers for Fangirl, a lot of you like the Statue of Liberty, and I find that adorable. We have a lot of mini Leslie Knopes in our audience.
That's lovely.
It was not something I would ever think
I
of,
wouldn't have
but
thought
like
that
several people online and offline gave that answer.
I love that.
Yeah, it's very charming.
It is very, very charming. Well, lots of things happening. I feel like we need another hour to really talk about all things live lit, but we are counting down the clock already out of time. Well, maybe this time next year in the new studio. Back for the annual book show.
I am excited about what will happen in Live Lit in the next year, and I'm excited to see what happens in the world in the next year as well.
Same. Any particular things in the Live Lit world you're looking forward to?
In the Live Lit world, I'm going to be really self-centered. I'm looking forward to our next show on 627, June 27th. The theme is Miss Manners. Manners are rife with gender, and also just interesting to talk about what we consider polite society. So I hope to see you all there.
If nothing else... I hope everyone follows you on Twitter, because as you announce the theme, every time I go, ooh, I have a thing I could write about that.
Awesome.
If nothing else, it just makes you write to hear about this series.
And if you do, if you are interested in, you know, in submitting to the show, you can find out more about us at miss-spoken.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Rosamund, R-O-S-A-M-U-N-D.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us this evening. Tonight's theme, well, it's our annual book show, but the theme underneath that umbrella of the book show is all about the untold stories and hidden narratives, because each year as we do this show, we always pick a topic and really focus around that. So we're talking about a lot of nonfiction. We're talking about real stories that sometimes aren't widely recognized or widely known, or sometimes stories that people want to be hidden stories. And so we're joined now by Dr. Elizabeth Sun from Northwestern University, who works in, you are a professor of theater and you have a new book out. You work in a lot of creative spaces. Welcome to the program. So glad you're with us tonight.
Thank you so much, Amy.
So tell us about your book, Embodied Reckonings.
So my book, Embodied Reckonings, Comfort Women, Performance, and Trans-Pacific Redress, looks at political and cultural aspects of contemporary performances in South Korea, Japan, and the United States that address the history of Japanese military sexual slavery. And in this book, I am interested in examining the relationship between art and activism that grapples with a history of sexual enslavement from the years leading up to and during World War II. And so by performances, I mean both social performances like protest, but also looking at legal performances like tribunals and aesthetic performances like theater productions. And I also look at memorial building projects as a way to think about how people on the ground are thinking of ways to reimagine what justice looks like for these women.
That's so interesting. And I feel like that's so connected to so many contemporary conversations.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, as we're talking, particularly, you know, as you're talking about memorials, I think that, you know, about a year ago, so much conversation started around Confederate monuments and what does it mean when we decorate and acknowledge public space in certain ways?
I think it's so important when we look at memorials, especially memorials that are to histories of silenced narratives or histories around violence against women, that we think about what is the importance of claiming public space? What does it mean to literally carve out a space in either a public park or across from the Japanese embassy in Korea, and think about how can we create a place where people can gather to remember the women, but also a place where people are protesting and actively teaching the history to other people. And so the conversations around the Comfort Memorials have been really interesting to me, especially here in the United States, because there's a lot of contention over where these memorials can be installed. And a lot of local activists advocate that these memorials have to be installed on public land so that they are not sequestered on private property, but they are on public land so that it becomes not only a statement that an official body such as a city council acknowledges and mm-hmm. is advocating for the women, but also these sites are in places where the public has easy access to the memorials. And also, for example, a memorial in Glendale, California is next to the public library. So immediately it sets up that framework that this is not only the site of commemoration, this is also the site of education.
Right, right. And so why did you pick this particular topic to write about?
I chose this particular topic because I've always been interested in how people use culture to address silenced histories. And about 10 years ago, I found out about these protests that were being held every week across from the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea. And these protests have been held since 1992 by these elderly survivors of Japanese military sexual slavery and their supporters. And I was really struck by how the supporters and activists were using public space as a means to raise awareness, but also to reimagine what justice might look like for the women. And for me, it was really important to write this book because I not only wanted to tell this history, but the history is not just the history of what happened to them during the war, but the history of the activism and the story that these women, the survivors, have been at the center of a transnational social movement to raise awareness, not just awareness about this particular history from World War II, but in general to think about what does it mean for us as a society to think about our responsibility for impeding a cycle mm-hmm. of impunity for perpetrators, but also what does it mean for us to really honor the stories and narratives of survivors of gender-based violence.
Right.
And so I felt really convicted to write this story about the women, their activism, but also to honor and acknowledge that it is a story that is not just a story that is between Korea and Japan. It is a transnational story, and it's a story that brings together not only activists, but also artists. And that was very important because I'm very interested in that relationship between artistic expression and political activism.
Right, definitely. And I mean, even as you're talking, I'm thinking even our language, even the words that we use to describe a thing or a movement is so essential. I mean, right. The difference between saying comfort women like sounds kind of like soft and supportive, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to military sexual slavery, that's really saying this is exactly what happened. And this is perhaps a narrative that a lot of people would prefer be forgotten.
Absolutely. And in the book, I talk about how the silencing of that history has happened on multiple levels. So on the state level, as the war was coming to a close, the Japanese military ordered the destruction of incriminating evidence. Now, all of that evidence was not destroyed. And then at the end of World War II, when there was the Tokyo Tribunal, during that war, not only the Japanese, but the U.S., U.S.-led allies who led the tribunal, were not interested in talking about crimes of sexual violence against women. They were more focused on crimes against POWs. Mm-hmm. And then within communities, especially my particular focus on South Korea, because it's a Confucian-influenced society where chastity is valorized. There was so much stigma and shame around what happened to these women. And so it was difficult, if not impossible, for them to share what happened to them within their communities, within their families. And then we see that coming down then to the individual level, where people have a myriad of reasons for deciding not to share this experience. And so in the book, it was really important for me to talk about the politics of memory. What are the structures of power that sustain different ways in which people both remember and forget certain aspects of this history? And how is that tied to both transnational state politics, but also how is that tied to communal desires? How is that tied to familial desires? How is that tied to individuals' desires to re-narrate their past?
So interesting. We have to take a little break, but we are talking with Dr. Elizabeth Sun, author of Embodied Reckonings, Comfort Women, Performance, and Trans-Pacific Redress. We are going to take a little break and continue this conversation here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special, our final broadcast, as far as we know anyway, from the Michigan Avenue Showcase Studio. It's lovely outside. It's always a pleasure to see everybody out walking around on a Saturday evening. But also, thank you for sharing part of your Saturday evening with us by the radio. We are talking, it's our annual book show. So we're talking about untold stories. We're talking nonfiction. We're talking hidden narratives, all that good stuff tonight. And we have Dr. Elizabeth Sun from Northwestern University with us. And she's the author of Embodied Reckonings, Comfort Women, Performance, and Trans-Pacific Redress. It is an excellent book. I recommend it very, very highly. We have been discussing it and many, many of the themes that fit so well with the show tonight. So I wonder, in all of your work that you do here as an author and also in theater and performance, and in that academic setting, what is your process for excavating a hidden narrative, especially when there's, you know, so often such large, dominant, widely recognized narratives sitting on top of it?
For me, it's been really important in working on this book to first honor and acknowledge that I'm not the first scholar to write about these women. Mm-hmm. There is a robust body of scholarly literature on the comfort women. But what I've noticed about that literature is that it has not focused, I think, in depth on this relationship between activism and artistic work. And specifically, nobody has really looked at performances. So by performances, I am talking about embodied means of expression. So I both look at aesthetic works like stage productions and memorial objects and the process around building these memorials, but I'm also interested in thinking about how in the everyday do people use their bodies as a way to fight for social and political change. Mm. And so in excavating those histories, it has been really important for me to both not only do archival research, but to be out in the field. And so I think it has been just really meaningful for me to do this research since 2007 and be out in the streets. For example, as I mentioned, these Wednesday demonstrations that happen in Seoul, South Korea, every Wednesday since 1992, rain or shine, it was critical for me to be out there. Because by being out there, standing alongside protesters and seeing how people move through the space, that's when I realized that people are not just there to advocate for state redress as they face the Japanese embassy, but as more people fill the space, they actually start turning their back to the embassy and they are directly facing the survivors. Mm. They are the main audience. So in that gestural turn from facing the embassy to then facing the women, that's where I saw, oh, this is what is happening here. This is not only a protest for redress, it is protest as redress. So they are thinking about, what does it mean for us to teach this history out on the streets? What does it mean for us to build a sense of community? A lot of the elderly survivors refer to supporters as their descendants. And I think it's so important that we talk about those minute ways in which people are connecting and really rethinking that justice is not just something that's in the hands of the state or the court. It is in the hands of all. So in the ways that we choose to honor and remember each other's stories, we are enacting justice.
Mm, I got goosebumps as you were describing that. That's what a simple thing to just turn a different direction, but what a huge, huge meaning behind it. That's very beautiful. What, as you began working on this project, what surprised you in that research?
I was surprised by the creative ways in which people were thinking of how to honor and remember the women's histories. So I have two examples that immediately come to mind. So when I was out at the Wednesday demonstrations in the summer of 2008, there was a group of Japanese citizens who were visiting, and they called themselves the Weekly Wednesday Troop. So they have been going around Japan performing the testimonies of Korean survivors as their way of raising awareness and as their way of advocating for change. And they would come out to the Wednesday demonstrations in Korea to perform for the women. So I saw them wearing headshots of the survivors. They were hanging around their necks. And then they would perform the testimonies of the survivors, but they learned the words in Korean so they could perform them and the survivors could understand. So I saw the survivors sitting there hearing their own testimonies being performed by Japanese citizens. And I thought that is a beautiful example of the ways in which people are using creative means to excavate a hidden history, but also thinking a way to honor the women. Mm-hmm. Another example that comes to mind, in 2011 in Seoul, South Korea, a realistically rendered bronze statue of an adolescent girl was installed in the space of the Wednesday demonstrations as a way to honor the women, but also to commemorate the long history of the Wednesday demonstrations. So it's this hauntingly beautiful bronze statue of a teenage girl seated in a chair next to an empty chair, and the empty chair evokes those who never returned home. And throughout Korea, and also here in the States, there are now a number of these bronze girl statues. People have built these statues, but they've also been finding ways to care for the statue. So people will knit scarves and hats and leave her gifts. There's an example of a statue in Haenam, South Korea, where somebody hand-knit these beautiful yellow slippers and somehow found a way to fit them onto
a statue. Right.
And what was great is this statue, the balls of her feet are actually connected to the ground. So someone had to get down on their knees, measure it, and figure out a way, how can I create this slipper as a way to adorn this statue? And what was so beautiful about that is not only the choice of color, yellow is the color of the social movement because of the ways in which in Korean culture it evokes hope and optimism and new birth, and then the ways in which they just decorated the slippers. And I thought, that's such a great example of the ways in which people are using their own gifts to honor and remember the women. And so for me, as a performance scholar, it's exciting to see that, because I see with the Weekly Wednesday Troop ways in which they're using public spaces to perform these women's testimonies, but also with this random person who knit these slippers, just to think about ways in which people are using the act of care, and that is through finding a way to adorn the statue as a way to commemorate this history, but to remember the women.
Right, and I find it so interesting that there's so many forms of storytelling that we've kind of touched on tonight, but a gesture is not usually one of those forms we think of, but nonetheless it is in this case.
Absolutely. And these are gestures that are repeated throughout. Mm-hmm. So the bronze statue always has a different hat.
She has
on
a big wardrobe.
She has a big wardrobe. Absolutely.
Right, right. And so through all of this activism, I mean, I think the relationship between art and activism is such an interesting one, and one I think that comes up a lot and that's been up a lot lately, right? And anywhere, all over the place, really, certainly here. And that relationship, I think, is one that's sometimes even wrestled with, is what is that responsibility that artists have to social issues?
And that's something that I teach in a lot of my classes, because I feel very passionate about cultivating a sense of social consciousness in my students so that they both understand that there is a history of theater artists in particular who have used the stage as a way to raise awareness, to commemorate a history, to raise a consciousness of a community. But I also want them to believe in their potentiality to create social and political change. And when we have these conversations, I always emphasize that we have to think about social and political change on a spectrum. That on the one hand, there's a way in which we sometimes really focus on visible change that's often either somehow mandated or connected to the state or to some other official body. But I really want students to think about the whole spectrum of what does it also mean for us to think seriously about raising the social and political consciousness of a community and to create the space where we can have a nuanced public dialogue on a difficult issue. Mm. And art, specifically theater, has immense potentiality to do that, to gather people in the same space and to really present a history, an issue, a topic in a nuanced way that will then activate an audience so that they will think about, okay, there's a sense of responsibility, there's a connection that I have to this history, and hopefully it may activate that audience to think there is a different way in which I can move through the world.
Mm-hmm. And often I think when big issues that are complicated and things we wrestle with, I think when they come to us in an accessible way, like music or theater or something like that, sometimes we can swallow it a little bit better and expand our thinking.
Absolutely. The ways in which art effectively moves us and shakes us, it can transform society. And so that's why I think it's so important that, especially as an educator for me, that we focus on making sure students remember that art can change the world.
Indeed.
Art is the weapon.
There you have it. The book is called Embodied Reckonings, Comfort Women, Performance, and Trans-Pacific Redress. Dr. Elizabeth Sun, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you so much.
All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Man, I love that song. It's so good. It's Amy Guth. This is a Saturday Night Special, the final Saturday Night Special, at least as far as I know, from the beautiful Michigan Avenue studio here at Tribune Tower. That's right. We are moving this show across the river to another building way up high. We will not be ground level. We will miss all of the waving. But nonetheless, the show will keep going just like it is, knock on wood. So tonight is the annual book show. That is the show I wanted to do for our send-off program. And the theme of the book show is the untold stories, those hidden narratives, things we talk about a lot on this program, certainly. And we have been talking with many people who deal with that in many different ways. Please welcome our next guest. I think we can start calling her a regular contributor soon enough. We've had her on a couple of times. Deborah Douglas, who is an award-winning journalist. She was previously with the Chicago Sun-Times. Her work has been in Oprah and American Prospect and Time and Ebony. And all. Pretty much if you've read something, you've definitely read her work. And also she has previously been teaching at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, and she's moving over to DePaul University as the Eugene Pulliam Distinguished Professor of Journalism. That is quite a bio. Welcome to the program, Deb Douglas. Hello, Deborah Douglas. How are you? Thanks for being with us.
I'm here, Amy. Hello. Thank you for such a wonderful introduction.
Well, you've done so many things. I'm like looking through your bio and I'm just like, there. I would need a whole show to get through all the things. You've done so very much. But one thing I did not mention is something I'm so fascinated by, and that is the MLK 50 Journalism, Justice Through Journalism Project, of which you are the managing editor. So that is another one of your many projects. And I think so much of your work really fits so well with our theme tonight about untold stories and hidden narratives. But I want to open that to you of how you see your work and all the ways that you see storytelling and journalism work in that way in your career.
Yeah, well, actually, MLK 50's sole purpose is to center the voices of people who aren't heard or aren't centered in everyday conversation and everyday news coverage. So for that particular project, we were focusing the voices of, you know, the poor, the economically marginalized, people of color, that sort of thing. But, I mean, from covering, you know, poor people to covering diversity and sunscreen. I'm all about, you know, putting people in the spotlight who aren't there already.
Right. And so how do you approach that? What is your personal approach to that? I think that's something that's really come up a lot this evening with our guests that we've been talking with. And that is about, you know, when you're up against a dominant narrative, when the loudest or most powerful voice has been the one kind of widely recognized by history, how do you, the storyteller, begin to unearth the and share and make sure the lesser known or less heard story is given its due?
Well, the first thing is that I'm commanded by the commandments of journalism to say something new. And the funny thing about the dominant narrative is that we've heard so much of it already. Whatever that universal story is, we know what that story is. There are just sort of a common myths or common tropes that pop up, like, you know, the myth of the American dream and that sort of thing. But so when I'm doing my work and I'm looking for what's new, part of that is looking for what's not being said. So that means that you have to look between the lines. And so, you know, if you can't find something new, then look for something nuanced. Look for another way to drive the conversation forward, but spotlighting something that people may see every day but not really notice. And to me, that's a really awesome challenge, to be able to surprise and delight people in that sort of way.
Right, certainly. And what's interesting, I think, about the MLK 50 project is that despite this being about that the work that Dr. King created many decades ago, it is still very relevant and even urgent right now.
Yeah, history is not the past, and there's a saying that says that history, that past is prologue. And so a lot of the winds of the civil rights movement are under assault right now. But for that particular project, we were very specifically looking at the economic realities of poor people in Memphis, but as an emblem of being poor or being a person of color in the United States. And so we didn't want to tell just the happy story of how far we've come. You know, that's a part of it. But we wanted to tell the whole truth. What has changed and what hasn't changed for other people. That's a part of the finding the nuance, or finding something new to say.
And in doing that, how do you believe that sharing perhaps under-discussed or underrepresented stories, how do you believe that in doing this work that those stories reshape history or inform the near future?
Yeah, well, the thing is that we don't even exist. We don't know that we exist unless we have a story about why we exist, right? So we grow up as children hearing stories about who we are and how we are and why we are. And so by centering marginalized voices, my goal is to help sort of explain and center who we are, why we are, and how we are of being a woman in society, being a person of color in society, being a person who's physically challenged, being a person who's a member of the LGBTQ community. You know, the examples, you know, run across a range of different identities and a range of ways that we walk through the world or carry ourselves in the world. And then when you hear the story of yourself, you can figure out where you fit in and how you can thrive. I mean, because ultimately, you know, my goal in my work is to bear witness and educate and inform, so people can figure out where they fit in this puzzle, this experiment that we're in democracy, which I'm really excited about, but it is such a puzzle. And so part of my work, it has to do with helping people figure out where they fit into that puzzle from an asset framing way, not from a deficit perspective.
That's very interesting you say that, because I think so much of the conversation right now when we talk about storytelling, especially in the journalism piece of that, it's, I think, almost met with like scoffing or pity. You know, it's really refreshing to hear you say that it's exciting, but it is a puzzle. Because I've often said right here on this program that, you know, journalism is complicated right now, but it also feels kind of like having a front row seat of history as it's all kind of reshaping and figuring itself out.
We are exactly having a front seat of history. I was just thinking about this earlier today. I live across the street from the Museum of Science and Industry. And when I was reading E. Tom McKaylee's book about the history of the Chicago Defender, I remember him writing about Frederick Douglass presenting at the World Columbian Exposition. And my all-time favorite, Ida B. Wells, was there also. And many other heavy hitters in the Black community, the early Black elite. And so the idea that I could walk down the street and know that I'm walking in the footsteps of Ida or walking in the footsteps of Frederick is really awesome, but it also is like throwing down a challenge to myself to make sure that I'm picking up the mantle and I'm doing something with what they started. I'm just not here or just existing. And I hope to engage people in a way where they feel like, you know, they have something to press for too, informed by the work of people like that, great people like that.
We're talking with journalist Deborah Douglass. We are going to take a little break, but when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation all about tonight's books program and storytelling, because it's not really just about books. It's really about stories, and stories take many forms and always have. And so we're going to take a break, come back, and continue this conversation about hidden narratives in our stories. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us in what we believe is our final show here in the Showcase Studio. I keep saying that, but it's a sentimental thing. I know for listeners who are like not down here looking in the window and all, it's like, well, whatever. We're just going to keep on listening, same as ever. Indeed, but we've been here in the Tribune Tower for a long, long time. So it's kind of a sentimental day, sentimental week as we're moving things to our new digs, but it's also a very exciting time. So what better show to do as our last here in the studio then the annual books show. And of course, each year we have a theme, and this year's theme is about the untold stories and the hidden narratives. And we've been talking with many fascinating people this evening on that very topic. And the guest we are talking with right now is no exception to that, Deborah Douglass. She is a journalist. She is a professor. She does all the things and knows lots and lots and lots about storytelling and truth and narrative. So Deborah, we were talking a little bit right before the break about how, how history is really, it's not a thing way back there. It's really this continuum, and we can experience it currently and really feel connected to history in interesting ways by making sure that we have unearthed all the narratives, or as many as possible, and we're looking at things from many different sides. And I wonder, as a professor of journalism, how you go about imparting that to your students, and how you know, I think it's very easy for anyone. And I think, you know, journalists think about this a lot and are trained to not do this. But I think for a young journalist starting out, it's very easy to kind of slip into the dominant narrative of the thing that's, you know, out there. And so how do you begin that conversation with your students and get them thinking about what's not being said?
I try to get them beating the streets pretty early. Kick them out of the classroom. I don't like to spend a lot of time talking at my students, because really this is about the art and craft of, you know, curating stories. And so when I send them out, I said, you know, I command them really, you know, in a kind way, and I command them to talk to people who don't look like them and sound like them, because it's so easy for students when they're just getting used to talking to strangers in the first place, right? To go to someone who looks like them. If you're a white girl, you know, you may feel more comfortable talking to a white girl. If you're a Black male, you may feel more comfortable talking to a Black male. So I command them to talk to people who don't look like them. And then I make a list. I'm like, talk to people who are the opposite race. Talk to people who are older than you. If you're short, talk to tall people, you know, that sort of thing, just to kind of like prick their consciousness. Because sometimes we're just walking around on autopilot, and it's just so easy just to just go with what feels comfortable to us. And to be honest, I faced that in the newsroom, too, when I was at the Sun-Times. I would tell my staff to go south of Roosevelt. Go see what the rest of the city looks like.
Indeed. Yeah. I want to back up to something you mentioned before the break. You were talking about the book that is describing and chronicling the history of the Chicago Defender and that book. And I wonder, there, you know, Chicago has such, when we think about Chicago literature, we think about fiction so very much, right? We think about these really iconic books like Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. You know, we think about like books that even based in reality took a fictional way. You know, we have our icons here. But I think books that are about history and pieces that have been very essential to Chicago reading are really fascinating. And I wonder if there's other, you know, other things you've read recently that bring that same thing to mind, because I think it's so, in particular, as you were talking about the history of the Chicago Defender, I think there's so much in that book that's quite that's very related to a lot of things now that not just journalists can benefit from understanding and revisiting.
Yeah, well, Eitan's book is really kind of like a roadmap.
Yeah.
You can read the book and then go places and stand on a corner and sort of close your eyes and imagine what that time was like. And you take in the sounds and the sights and the smells and that sort of thing. It's another way of experiencing your built environment. I also just downloaded Barracoon by Zora Neale Hurston. And it's the story of Cujo Lewis, who was on the last boat that came over in the transatlantic slave trade. I haven't cracked it open yet, but I'm excited about it because I actually have friends in Chicago who came from the town in Alabama where that ship landed. So that's really exciting to me that this history is just right here and that I'm a part of this really awesome through line. Also, I've been doing some research on the U.S. Civil Rights Trail. The federal government has now an officially designated trail of site across mostly the American South that were seminal to the Civil Rights Movement. And they debuted a site, a website, an interactive website that's actually pretty fun in April. And so I've been doing some deep research into writing about that trail, and I plan to hit the trail in the next couple of months or so, starting with the Smithsonian African American Museum, the Blacksonian, and then going down through Virginia and the Carolinas and working my way over to Georgia and Alabama, Mississippi, then on up to Tennessee, and maybe with a stop in Little Rock. But this history is right there. And the more and more I delved into my research, I realized that as a journalist, I've actually interviewed a lot of people who were active in that movement. Like last summer, I interviewed Diane Nash for a story I wrote about the death of Dick Gregory for the Chicago Reporter. And Diane Nash was active in the Nashville movement, and she was the founder of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, mm-hmm. which is something I learned about by picking books off the bookshelf at my grandmother's house because her children had left their college books back at the house. So I started reading their books when I was in junior high and high school. You know, and then we have Reverend Jackson here in town. He's living history, right? And so, and I interviewed Bree Newsom in April with MLK 50. She's a young woman who scaled the flagpole in South Carolina and yanked the Confederate flag down.
Right, right.
Because after the Mother Emanuel murders, Clemente Pinckney, who was a state senator in South Carolina, his funeral train was going to go past the South Carolina State House. And she thought that it was insensitive to have the flag flying there when he died in such a horrible way. And so she yanked the flag down. So I talked to Bree, and I'm like, you know what? You could drive down to South Carolina, North Carolina, and you could actually talk to living history. Bree Newsom is right there.
Right.
So to me, it's just right here. All we have to do is reach out and touch it.
Right. You know, and to me, I'm thinking with our last guest, Dr. Elizabeth Sun from Northwestern University, she was talking about how story took a lot of different forms, even a gesture or, you know, honoring a statue or not honoring a statue. And I think there's a lot of that here as you're talking about the U.S. Civil Rights Trail and stories connected very tightly and even loosely to it. I think the thing really that is in my mind right now is about all the forms that story can take. We think about it as like oral storytelling, written word, things like that. And, but yet there, you know, sometimes it's a place and sometimes it's an action from a person that has a story around it. And sometimes it's a gesture, you know, it can be so many different things, which I think is so fascinating about story.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I'm a product of the Great Migration. My family is from Mississippi and Tennessee, and I was born here in Chicago. My dad ran a business here for many, many years in Austin. We were part of the second wave. And then my parents split. My mother moved to Detroit. So I have a lot of experience going through that on the road trips down south and that sort of thing. And so it's, as a journalist, it's really fascinating to me to think about Ida B. Wells' journey from Memphis, Tennessee, to Chicago. She actually was the, as Nicole Hannah Jones said at a fundraiser the other day at the Oakwood Center, she was the first data journalist or the first Black female data journalist, because her reporting proved that lynchings weren't occurring because Black men were fresh with white women. It was because they were a threat to white owned businesses in Memphis, and a lot of other reasons too, but that was one of the main reasons that she found. Well, they tore up her printing press and threatened her life and said, if you ever come back to Memphis, we'll kill you. So she ended up settling here in Chicago. And so there is no monument to Ida B. Wells in the city. And anybody who watches social media or the news will know that her great-granddaughter has, in a committee that she's working with, has been spearheading a fundraising effort to build a monument in honor of her great-grandmother. That's one of the missing stories, right? And it's not just the story of the Wells family. It's not the story, just the story of journalism. It's a story about all the missing women, right? Because fewer than 3% of monuments and statues in the United States are dedicated to women. And you'd be hard-pressed to walk around Chicago and actually find statues of women, let alone a Black woman. When I was married once in another lifetime, and I put that challenge to my ex-husband. I'm like, where are the women? And I remember he pointed at the Chicago Board of Trade way at the top. And at the top, there's a statue of Ceres, the goddess of agriculture. I always jokingly said she's the goddess of cereal. But I'm like, oh, okay, there's a woman. So the greater the effort to surface women's stories and to center women's stories and to erect monuments and tell that story, then women have a fuller idea of their positionality in society and their potential in society.
Indeed. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I wish we had a whole other hour to talk about all this stuff. You always bring so many good insights and so much great information to the show. Thank you for being with us, Deborah Douglas. We shall talk
Thank you,
with
Amy.
Well, we shall talk with you next time. Thank you so much.